For too many of us, it's become safer to retreat into our own bubbles, whether in our neighborhoods or on college campuses or places of worship, or especially our social media feeds. Surrounded by people who look like us and share the same political outlook and never challenge our assumptions. And increasingly, we become so secure in our bubbles that we start accepting only information, whether it's true or not, that fits our opinions, instead of basing our opinions on the evidence that is out there. In the course of a healthy debate, we prioritize different goals and the different means of reaching them. But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point, if you're tired of arguing with strangers on the internet, try talking with one of them in real life.
It'd be too easy to talk about nothing, to talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm balling, I'm stunting. Be too easy chasing the fame, playing the game. It'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and per usual, I am here with my co-host, Kent Strait. What's up, Kent?
I have nothing funny to say.
Well, then.
Here's the funny thing.
Okay.
Here's the only funny thing. When I was in the car on the way here, I had three funny things to say, and I've forgotten them all.
Okay.
Because, largely, I just met Darren McCarty in the lobby. And
old news, I met him last week.
I know. See, you met him a couple weeks ago, and I met him today.
Did you get a picture with him?
No.
Oh, I totally took a picture with him.
I'm not a fame whore.
Okay.
I am. Okay, sure. So, and all of
this podcast isn't going to do it for me, so I got to have pictures with Darren McCarty.
All the funny things just left my head. But I will say, segueing into the topic, I'm very excited about this week's panel and this week's topic.
Okay.
Because I feel like, even as a Gentile, I feel like I have a better handle on the Jewish faith than I do on some of the other topics that we're at. So I feel like I may talk more.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So when Kent – I'm starting to realize this. When Kent doesn't know much or feel – well, he knows a lot. He knows a lot of stuff. This is why he's on my trivia team, because he'll get an answer and I'll always go, why do you know that? And it's not like he was preparing for it or Jeopardy or anything like that. But I've noticed that Kent acts a certain way when the topic is kind of outside of his wheelhouse. You'll see him start fidgeting with things in the room. He'll just start playing with the C-3PO Buddha over there and things like that.
Well, last week we had a lovely, wonderful panel of Muslims on, and all of them literally know 100% more about the topic than I do. So I feel like it would just be noise in the hurricane if I, you know, so.
Well, fair enough.
Yeah.
So.
But I was in senior year in Fiddler on the Roof. That's why I feel like I've got a handle on the topic.
Because that encompasses the entire Jewish culture.
It.
Yes. Which was my mom's favorite musical growing up, by the way. Mm-hmm. And never mind. So let's just jump right into bios. We are continuing our series, Sacred Space. We started off 2 weeks ago with an episode titled, What is Christianity? Then last week, as Kent said, we had a lovely panel of Muslims on. That panel was, What is Islam? And then this week is, What is Judaism? And this is kind of interesting because I do believe that this is the first time as a show we've actually focused on the Jewish faith. We've had Jewish people on, but we've not had a particular panel that focused on the ins and outs of the religion. So I'm very excited about this panel. And like Kent, I probably have a better handle on Judaism than I do on Islam. But I've been spending a lot of time with a Muslim professor, so I'm starting to get more knowledgeable on that as well. So that being said, we have a fantastic panel. We have five panelists here, four in the room and one on the Skype line. Real quick, I'm just going to read their bios. And if I mispronounce anybody's names, please correct me. I want to pronounce people's names correctly. Is it Sarah Allen?
Yeah, you got it.
All right, I got it. Okay. So Sarah Allen grew up in Metro Detroit across the street from the elephants at the Detroit Zoo. After graduating from the University of Michigan, she moved to Chicago to join Teach for America as an early childhood educator. Family in the emerging food scene in the city brought her back home, where she spent 4 years as a director of education at Temple Shir Shalom. Shir Shalom, all right. She is currently the executive director of Repair the World, a national Jewish organization that seeks to engage the Jewish community in transformational service learning around the country.
One tiny correction. I'm executive director of Repair the World Detroit.
We're a national organization
with a national executive director.
Correcting that. There we go. Detroit. There we go. All right. Sarah is thrilled to be working with the many passionate people and organizations in Detroit. For Sarah, Judaism is a commitment to creating a better world for all communities. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And on the Skype line, we have Dr. Sharon Weiss-Greenberg. Did I pronounce that correctly, Sharon?
Yeah, you got it.
All right. And Sharon is the executive director of the Jewish Orthodox Feminist Alliance. She was recently named by the Jewish Forward as a Forward 50 Jew of Influence and by the Jewish Week as a person to watch as a 36 under 36 honoree. Sharon has held a variety of professional roles, including director of recruitment at – I am going to mess this up. So can you just say that? Because –
It's Yeshiva Maharad. It's the first women's yeshiva to ordain women rabbis.
Okay, awesome. At Camp Stone. Sharon has served...
Oh, sorry, that was a different thing. That was Rosh Moshe Shabbat. That's just head of camp.
Oh, you're head of camp at Camp Stone. Okay, sorry. There was not a period. I'm sorry. Sharon has served as the co-director and Orthodox advisor of the Orthodox Union Jewish Learning Initiative on campus at Harvard Hillel. And as the first Orthodox woman chaplain at Harvard University. She has taught at Yeshiva University High School for Girls. Is it Yavna Academy in New Jersey?
Yep.
And the Denver Academy of Torah High School. Sharon earned her doctorate at New York University in Education and Jewish Studies. Thank you so much for being on the line with us, Sharon.
Thanks for having me.
Before we go on to the next bio, I did want to point out that I didn't catch who it was. But somebody out there does a 36 under 36 list.
There's one in Detroit as well.
Yeah.
Is it because
I think every city does this
it's
now.
A factor of 369 and 12?
I don't know.
Okay. All right.
It's because if you don't make it to the.
We can explain if you'd like.
Go, yes.
Yeah. Please, Sharon.
Oh, it's too high. It's 2 times 18, and 18 is the Jewish number.
All right. Okay.
Well, there you go.
And it's like an accomplishment to have not. 36 yet, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
Nice. I'm trying to make it on our 40 under 40. I've got 2 years here in Detroit to make that.
You got this.
Yeah, I got this. So next up, we have, is it Miss or Mrs. Ren Heck?
Mrs.
Okay. Heck, not Heck. Mrs. Ren Heck, she's a senior director of adult Jewish engagement at Jewish Community Center of Metro Detroit. Ren hails from the East Coast state of Massachusetts. She was a former educator with supplemental Jewish education, and Ren previously worked at Congregation Shir Tikva.
Correct.
Okay. As director of education and Congregation
Sherezedek
as director of the Berman Center for Jewish Education. Now, here's the deal. I don't know why I'm struggling so much because Kent and I we're both Christians, and so we have what we call the Old Testament and the New Testament. So all these names are pretty much there. So I don't know why I'm struggling
fine
so much.
Until you introduce an apostrophe into it. Because like sometimes there's what I consider strange punctuation, and then I have no idea how to say it.
I have a hard time with English versions of Hebrew as well. Next up, I'm sorry. Ren, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And then we have... Shimon, is it Levy?
Levy.
It's Levy. Okay. Very short bio here, but super impressive still. Israeli born, served in the IDF for 8.5 years, lives in the University District in Detroit, and he is now an entrepreneur here in the city.
Oh, my God. I love it. Best bio ever.
Awesome. Coolest bio ever written. It's a huge bio. Shimon, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And then last but not least, we have Mr. Jacob Smith, who I need to thank for actually getting this panel put together. If it weren't for Jacob, only Jacob would be a panelist today. Jacob Smith is an entrepreneur and social justice advocate in Detroit. He is a Next Gen board member and co-founder of The Returning Citizen, a podcast for people coming out of prison and their families, sharing stories, connecting resources, and building community. As a matter of fact, you were on our episode about mass incarceration. That's how we met. And he holds a bachelor's in business administration from the University of Michigan. Jacob, thank you so much for being back on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. So let's dive right into questions here. Talk briefly about if you were a convert, talk about your conversion. If you were born into the faith, talk about your faith journey up until now. And we don't have to go in any particular order. Just say your name and we'll be off to the races.
I'll start. My name is Ren, and I am, I think, the only one in the group who converted to Judaism. I converted 24 years ago.
Okay.
And I was formerly a Christian, Protestant, raised as a Congregationalist.
Okay.
And made the choice.
Here in Michigan?
Nope, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. Because Congregationalism
actually was raised
here
as a Protestant, went to Catholic all-girls high school.
Okay.
Converted to Judaism.
Okay.
So I kind of hit. I'm still waiting for Buddhism.
All right.
My decisions for converting were not that I was refuting my background, but I was embracing a new pathway.
Okay.
And for me, and this is, I'm not trying to be offensive to anyone, but Jesus Christ didn't hold a leadership position for me. And Judaism spoke to me from the scholastic learning of it spoke to me, as well as the emphasis on family.
Okay.
So it seemed like a seamless journey choice. So that's what I chose. But I must say that the day I converted, I cried all day long.
Okay.
Not because of what I was leaving, but recognizing that as a Jew, I could now be persecuted for my religion. And I had never experienced that prior.
Hmm. So I believe you're the only convert in the room, if I'm not mistaken, correct? Okay. So follow-up question on that. You left Christianity, and I guess it wouldn't even really matter what religion you were leaving. There are people who, if you're religious, hey, you're raised Christian, your family feels like they've instilled values in you, they've instilled their faith, or how they understand faith. Was that hard for your family when you said, hey, you know, I'm Jewish now, or was it accepted easily?
It wasn't necessarily hard for them. They wouldn't say that it was difficult. There were other – I come from a large family, and there were others that had converted to other religions. What was hard and is still hard is the anti-Semitism that comes out. They're not purposeful in it. It just comes out from where they come from.
Okay.
So still experiencing it today after, you know, 20-odd years of being a Jew. But that's – they wouldn't say it's difficult.
Okay. Thank you. Who's next?
I can go.
All right.
So this is Jacob. So different story. So I was raised in West Bloomfield, Michigan, which is a very high concentration of high Jewish population. Basically, I was born Jewish to Jewish parents, a long lineage of Jewish ancestry. Raised kind of in a traditional Reform Jewish communal upbringing, so had a bris, had a bar mitzvah, the whole bit. Went to Hebrew school growing up.
We're very similar. I have been to a bar mitzvah.
Lovely.
Yes. You have so much in common.
It was great.
But at the same time, I think for me, especially as a child, a lot of the aspects of my Judaism. Celebrating major holidays and different things. For me, Reform Judaism, I kind of always assumed as a kid that it kind of meant choose your own path. I didn't even like know that it was a formal movement until later in my life, which is kind of funny in retrospect. But so I think I kind of disengaged from some aspects of the faith side of Judaism, but was always very closely connected to the cultural side of my Judaism, as well as maintaining what for some would seem like a lot of tradition, but compared to more observant Jews, from my perspective, it was very minimal traditional expression of my Judaism. So celebrating Passover and Hanukkah and some different things. And then as an adult, I've really kind of dove deeper into my Judaism specifically through community work. So I serve on the Next Gen board through the Jewish Federation of Metro Detroit. I'm involved in other leadership roles within the Jewish community. That really is my kind of prominent expression of my Judaism is through community work. And Sarah and I were actually talking about this over coffee the other day. But more recently, as a result of a really amazing program that I was at with Sharon over the summer, have really started thinking more about the other social justice work that I engage with through a Jewish lens in a way that I hadn't necessarily previously. I kind of had thought of that work being separate from my Jewish faith, but now I'm starting to really understand that it really all fits within what it means for me to be Jewish. And I'm excited to talk about that today.
All right. Sharon, what about you?
Hey, so I grew up modern Orthodox in that we kept the Sabbath, we kept kosher dietary laws. I went to Jewish day school through high school. Jewish day school is basically all day from like private school. What's interesting, though, is that my family identified as modern Orthodox, but there weren't, where I was living, in various points in time. I grew up in Cleveland, Atlanta, and then Minneapolis. There wasn't necessarily a modern Orthodox day school. So I would switch from one school where I was the only one of a handful of kids who observed the Sabbath and Kashrut. And then I would be in another school where the next year where everyone pointed at my feet and told me that I wasn't modest because I was wearing sandals without socks. So I really flip-flopped a lot, which made me semi-tolerant, I guess, of the various elements of our Jewish community, but it was also a tad confusing. And I would say that in terms of who I am as a modern Orthodox Jew, my home was very important. Camp was also a huge part of what shaped me as a Jew. And I differ from my home in some ways in that I strongly identify as a feminist. At this point, my parents have come along for the journey, but they were just simply confused at first, and they didn't understand. So in some ways, I would say I would be considered to be more strict of some laws, such as I wear something on my head as a sign of marriage at all times, but at the same time, I will lead services within a context that works from where I sit in terms of Orthodox Jewish law. So, like, in some ways, I'm more progressive, in some ways, I'm more strict, but it's an interesting sort of journey. And basically, all this happened organically through time. I would say that until my senior year of college, I was a standard modern Orthodox Jew who just had a loud mouth and a personality and didn't realize that after leaving a single-sex space, which was what most of my education was until post-college, I didn't realize that things would be limited to me as a woman. So overall, Judaism shaped my life. I went to Jewish schools until NYU, pretty much. So my master's, my PhD, everything was all, in a Jewish sort of bubble. And I'm a professional Jew. So in more recent years, I've tried to become more exposed and interact far more with people who are not just like me, which is that's been in the past like 10, 15 years. But until I was 20-something, I would say I was really in a bubble.
Okay.
All right. So this is Shimon Levy. Very similar to a lot of the people on the panel, but vastly different. My story is a bit unique in the sense that I'm Israeli, born and raised. And in Israel, just to give you a snapshot of my background, my mother immigrated to Israel and was born on the ship on the way to Israel in 1956 from Morocco, which is why her middle name is Jerusalem. And my father is first generation Israeli, where his father, my grandfather, immigrated to Israel in 1933, vis-a-vis crossing the desert, from Yemen, crossing the desert to Israel as an orphan with his brother over the time span of 2 years. So it's a very unique perspective. So I'm what you'd find as a Sephardic, North African, Israeli Jew. And in Israel, your community is obviously where you're brought up and raised, and everybody were Jewish. Everybody, without exception. So I didn't really have a Jewish journey because everybody around me were Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
All of the institutions, all of the transit system, the governance, everything was Jewish to a certain degree. My Jewish journey actually started when I was 10 years old. My parents were sent as diplomats to Nepal. So we spent 3 years in Nepal and 2.5 years in Australia. And that's the first time where I actually was exposed to multiculturalism. And what does it mean to experience different people with different backgrounds? But then I went back to Israel and, as you said, served in the military for quite a bit. So it was back to an environment, a very singular environment where people there were all from the same background with the same with the same understanding of what faith is and to what degree is it applicable. The funny thing is that my Jewish journey just amplified by my move to the States. So about 5 years ago, I came here for graduate school. I went to Boston for 2 years. And for the first time, going into a synagogue to celebrate my cousin's son bar mitzvah, I saw a rabbi, but this rabbi was a woman. This was Saturday. She had a yarmulke and a tzitzit on her, which are prayer scarf. And she was playing an electric guitar and singing into a microphone on Shabbat. And for me, coming from Israel, the land of Orthodox Judaism, was just mind-blowing. So I would say that it is still a work in progress.
Okay.
I think that the ability to be here for so long has exposed me to the vastly different communities, whether it's, as Jacob mentioned, Reform Judaism, whether it's people who converted. My girlfriend that we've been together for 3 years converted to Judaism, and we're building a life together. It is an ongoing process, and it is an ongoing journey.
Okay.
Now, I did want to follow up just on a part of Shimon's bio when you did a lengthy stint in the Israeli Defense Force. Do I take that to mean that there's no one in this building that you couldn't kill five different ways? Okay.
That was probably 50 pounds ago.
Okay.
Yes. Still applicable. Okay. Still applicable.
Don't start nothing, won't be nothing.
Did you shake this man's hand?
That's an international rule. Sarah, you.
I wish I'd gone before Shimon. My story is pretty boring. I grew up in the suburbs of Detroit, Huntington Woods specifically,
okay.
And I like what Sharon said about a bubble. I very much grew up in the Metro Detroit Jewish community bubble. Huntington Woods has a very large Jewish population. I went to Burton Elementary School and had one token non-Jewish friend in my class, which is really unusual.
It's a totally different type of token. When I feel like when I was always like the token black guy, right? Token non-Jew, token
yeah.
Gentile. Is that what it was like
token
you had?
Token Gentile. Claire was our token Gentile friend.
Shout out to Claire.
Shout out to Claire. And I got to help her decorate her Christmas tree.
All right.
Really lovely. So I grew up going to a Reform temple. We don't have to get into what Reform, Conservative, Orthodox is, but actually a temple where Ren used to run the religious school program. And I called it the Kumbaya Temple growing up, and I hated every second of being there.
And, I was not the director.
Ren was not the director. She's not the director.
Not then.
It would have been so much better.
Oh, absolutely.
Ren replaced that lady, and everything.
Exactly.
Everything's different now.
Totally.
We should try it again.
So I very strongly associated Judaism with going to a place that I did not enjoy and being among mostly people I did not enjoy. And I didn't feel very connected to prayer or to God or to worship in the way that I experienced growing up. My one strong connection to the Jewish faith was summer camp. Like Sharon said, I went to Jewish summer camp as well. I think a lot of Jews in our area, I actually met Jacob through Jewish summer camp in high school. And that was really what connected me to being Jewish. And as a child, I didn't even necessarily connect Jewish summer camp with being a Jew or with having faith or with being a part of this community. It was just fun. It was what I did every summer. So if you asked the 13-year-old Sarah if she would be a Jewish professional as an adult, she would have laughed at you. But here I am working in the Jewish community, and I absolutely love it. And I attribute that to this journey of my Judaism and figuring out what as a part of Judaism is most important to me. And like Jacob said and others have said, to me, it's the community, and that's what resonates. And as I continue on my Jewish journey, I'm finding out more and more that to me, being a Jew also means reaching out to other communities and starting to build bridges. And so that's where I am. And like Shimon said, it's ongoing.
Okay.
Beyond being a monotheistic faith, what are some of the central tenets of the Jewish faith? Like what makes Judaism unique in a world where people often claim all religions teach the same thing?
I think one of the tenets that we would emphasize is what we call tikkun olam, which is repairing the world. That is a very strong tenet of who we are and what we teach and what we expect. We expect our Jews to go out in the world and to make it a better place?
I think another tenet of Judaism is we're encouraged to ask questions. And I see that as being something that is so fundamentally Jewish. We're encouraged to challenge each other in a productive way and to ask why. And to me, that resonates.
As a Christian, I can tell you that it's just the opposite. We are encouraged to not ask questions.
Do not question the pastor.
Yes.
All right.
I think something else unique in my experience with Judaism as compared to some friends of other faiths is just the adherence to tradition, even for Jews that steer secular. It's very common for secular Jews to still engage with some aspect of tradition in their expression of their Judaism, whether that's having a bar mitzvah, whether that's lighting Hanukkah candles. My girlfriend laughs at me. She was raised Christian, and she laughs that I say that I'm, not particularly observant with my Judaism at all, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But from her perspective, it's like I'm constantly doing
right.
Jewish things.
Right.
So I think it's unique in that there's aspects of tradition that are passed down that I think this is even playing off of what Sarah was saying as well, like things that I don't even think about as being expressions of Judaism that are passed down that I carry on, even though it's like just
right.
Traditions that are just part of how I was raised. And it just so happens that it's part of my culture as a Jew.
Yeah, to comment on your girlfriend looking at things that way, like to the degree that you don't do something, anybody doing that thing that you don't do, it seems like a really big deal. I mean, I would think now within your own community, someone might look at you and go, yeah, I mean, he's not super observant. But to me, you're just as observant as, the Hasidic Jew because you're doing things that I just don't do that are outside of my my experience. So that might be where she's coming from.
Let me ask you, Jacob, this. Let me ask you just from a so I can baseline how observant you are.
Yeah.
As we sit here, it is the dead of winter.
Mm-hmm.
It is 5:45 at night, and it's a Wednesday.
Yeah.
If it was a Friday, would you not be here?
So I'm not Shomer Shabbat. I don't observe the Sabbath
okay.
at all.
That's, that answers my question.
Respect the hell out of people that do.
Okay.
So I have deep respect for the concept. I would love at some point in my life to be more formal with my observance of the Sabbath personally. It's just something that I've thought okay. about a lot.
There's a lot of cool stuff that happens on Friday, though. So it just seems like,
But for real.
Friday gets cooler
Sharon
and cooler.
I agree with you, but in a different way.
Yeah, I kind of I do carry on the wisdom, though, to that point. I do really highly value taking time out as a result of a very influential experience I had in Israel, realizing what it looks like for secular Jews to observe the Sabbath. Was highly influential for me in my understanding of oh my gosh, I can fully unplug, but it's not from Friday night to Saturday night. I'm not going through the actual traditions and rituals. So okay. if that makes sense. So it's like a
yeah.
That's a perfect example. Yep. I don't keep kosher. I don't but I do celebrate a very basic version of Hanukkah, Passover, Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. It's, again, from an outside perspective looking in, it might appear that I'm doing a lot with my Judaism traditionally, but Sharon may be sitting there laughing at me from New York.
I'm not laughing at you. I would say the language here is very important. I would say that people who are Orthodox or who ascribe to conservative Jewish law are observant. And observant in that they're I say something that sets apart Judaism is that there's a great amount of education and intellectual rigor that's necessary in order to be observant. That's why people go to day schools. That's why you could spend a lifetime learning Jewish texts. There's just so many of them, and they're so rich and so complicated. And you need that in order to be Jewish. You need to know how to do things. It's a very action-oriented Judaism for those who are observant, I would say. What I would say is that anyone can be religious and create ritual and what have you in their own way or to their affiliations way. So to me, that's a very huge way that Judaism distinguishes itself from other religions, in that we're not so into faith. Like, if you look to people who have left Judaism, I mean, there are a lot of people who are Jews who are now atheists and now humanists. Like, you know, probably an abnormally huge number of people, but I think that if you go around to and would observe different rabbi sermons, they're not saying like believe in God. It's just sort of like it's really action. It's do good. It's observe. It's whatever that rabbi is telling people to do. But it's always a do. It's very little of just believe. Belief is not huge, I would say, in Judaism, which is, you know, interesting and differentiating.
If I can chime back in there, because I think that's such an amazing point. Even the way that the question is phrased, beyond being a monotheistic faith, I know plenty of Jews that are atheistic Jews.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even an inherent, depending on who you ask, it's not even an inherent assumption that Judaism is defined by belief in God. So Judaism exists as a culture. It exists as a series of traditions that are passed down. It exists as a faith. There's lots of in a way that I think is much different than particularly Christianity in its expression. That in Christianity, it's kind of like if you don't believe in God, that's kind of
right
pulling the legs out from the.
Well,
the
I guess yeah. That's a big deal. You don't believe in God, you're not a Christian. By definition, you don't believe in God or Allah, you are not a Muslim by definition. Let me push back on that for a second there. My understanding of Judaism is, I mean, it is monotheistic. It does believe in a message of a God picking a specific people and impressing a message into them over time. You are not Hindu, right? Hindus have thousands of gods, right? So Judaism has one God, but you do have a God, right? I don't know that I've ever seen anything right. in Judaism say there is no belief in God. So I guess the question isn't about culture so much. Like, if you do not believe in God, I'm getting the sense that, yes, you could be culturally Jewish, but you could not be religiously Jewish.
I think it's important to talk about...
And you can correct me on this if I'm wrong.
I think for non-Jews, it's really important to understand the different denominations of Judaism, Reform, Conservative, right. Orthodox, and, you know, a plethora of other types of Jews. And for different Jews, there are different ways of thinking and different amounts of acceptance and tolerance. For me, and I'm actually going through an Intro to Judaism class with my fiancé who's not Jewish, and he wanted to just learn some of the basic tenets of Judaism. My rabbi, who's a Reform rabbi, would say, it's okay if you don't believe in God. We'll talk about it. We'll learn together. Maybe you have a different understanding of a higher power, of some sort of spiritual guide.
Uh-huh.
And that's okay. And you can still be a Jew, and we will still welcome you as a Jew. For other denominations and in other congregations, that might not be
right.
the same response you would hear from a rabbi.
Right, because within Reform Judaism, my basic understanding of Reform Judaism, obviously, you know, as Christians, we believe Jesus is the Messiah, right? That's where we differentiate between you know, Jews and Christians. My experience with Reform Jews, I remember we had this huge debate. We actually had a formal debate between a Christian pastor and a Reform Jewish rabbi, and I was floored when they got to this question of the Messiah, where I guess the teaching was, we are the Messiah. It's on us to change the world, kind of repair the world. There's not someone who's coming. We are it. Now, he could have been misrepresenting that view. I don't know. But this seems in line with kind of that idea, what you were just saying there, Sarah.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, go ahead, Sharon.
Sorry, I would just say that when it comes to belief in God, I think it's just not a topic that's broached. I don't know that people, like, certainly the Orthodox community, people would say, oh, it's not, it's fine to not believe in God, but just people don't talk about it. The only time where it does come up and it becomes relevant is when you talk about polytheism. And to be honest, many people see Christianity as polytheistic because you have
the Trinity, yes.
Trinity. The one thing that I would also say, though, there is this new sort of phenomenon within the Orthodox community where people talk about being orthoprax. And that basically means that there are people who ascribe to Orthodox Judaism because of the values, because of community, because of the bonding, because there's a lot of great things that come with being a part of a religious community, but they don't necessarily believe in it. So the language that's being created for, and it's unclear how many people would fall into this category, is orthoprax, but there are people who will observe Shabbat, they'll observe kashrut, they'll pray three times a day, but not believe a word that they're saying. And that's sort of this new conversation. But the fact that they've created a language for it, I think, is a big deal.
I think it's also really important to clarify that these are American distinctions, so Reform, conservative. So I want to pass this over to Shimon, because in Israel, it's completely different.
In Israel, this conversation, with the utmost respect, is non-existent. It is very, very binary. It is very, very binary. You're either secular or you're religious. And if you are religious, then you are Orthodox. The question is how Orthodox you are. The approach to these questions about Jews being atheist or potentially Jews being Reform or defining themselves, what does it mean to be on their path of Judaism, and how does it translate in their day-to-day, and how do they celebrate Hanukkah? How do they light their candles? And how do they sit around the Passover table and ask the questions, and whether it's social justice questions or just questions about the Torah, is something that I have never experienced until I actually moved to the States. The fact that you engage in a discussion around things that are supposed to be given, things that are supposed to be understood, and things that are supposed to be uniformed across everybody whom you know, your community, your parents. You know, it's one of these questions when a child says, wait, but why do I have to do this? And the mom says, because. You know, because.
Shimon, what was that like for you, and how has your Judaism changed since moving to the States?
Tell
us the journey.
Fascinating. I want you to answer that, but I think you're dealing with this with modernity, right? You know, modernity and postmodernity are things that other areas of the world aren't necessarily having conversations around or dealing with. And so I think that religion, whether it be Christianity, whether it be Islam, whether it be Judaism, whether it even be you know atheism, although atheism isn't a religion, you get what I'm saying. They're dealing with it within a postmodernist mindset that other areas of the world, the Middle East, are not necessarily dealing with in the same ways.
I'm not sure if I would equivocate it to that, and simply because of the reason that when Israel was established 70 years ago, mm-hmm. there was a need to create a status quo. To create a status quo from the immigrants from Eastern and Western Europe, who were the more intellectual people, the doctors, the lawyers, the CPAs, and the people from North Africa that immigrated with nothing but the clothes on their back. And as soon as they hit the ground in Israel, they kissed the floor as expecting to see honey and milk come out of the ground, because this is what they were taught for years and years and years. So in 1964, an agreement in Israel called the Status Quo Agreement was signed between the religious Orthodox community to the secular governance at the time, which basically created an ability, a fusion, to create just a cohesion around the populace, the Israeli populace, to work together towards a better future. But the experience itself, and especially the experience that I've been fortunate to take a part of over the past 5-plus years being in the States, is second to none. It changes you inside and out. It opens your mind not only per religion, but politically, culturally, multiculturally. You know, it stations your belief and your spectrum of understanding vastly different than where it previously is, simply because of exposure. Now, don't get me wrong. Like my first year here, seeing the rabbi at my cousin Sam's bar mitzvah, or going to a shul where somebody would hand me a mic, and like Friday night, and I was like, should I speak into the mic? Like, it's Friday night. Like, I was not used to these things. But if you ask me, kind of like 30,000 feet overview, it has definitely changed me personally for the better, simply because of the empowerment component behind it. If you make a decision based on knowledge and based on the exposure and the experiences that you've been given, if you've been granted access to, it's completely different than realizing them through a reality that just provides you, you know, with two options.
Okay. Let me just ask a question about life in Israel for a second, because I notice you just mentioned a 30,000-foot overview. Let me do like a 6-foot overview for just a second. And I notice that you are being an intellectual and well-educated helps, but you are more fluent in your second language than most Americans I know are in their first. And I'm wondering, is that representative of life in Israel? Does everybody speak two languages at least?
So I mean, I have been fortunate. So we traveled around growing up, so okay. I was able to pick up on English as well as some other languages that my mom was pretty adamant about. But that being said, I think Israelis affiliate themselves more than anybody else with Americans. Mm-hmm. Per cultures, mm-hmm. HBO Go, like they're big, like there are petitions in Israel to like let Netflix go and like Amazon, like they are all over it. Israelis feel very, very connected to American culture and movies, subtitles with or without. That's how many Israelis actually learn English, through seeing movies without subtitles.
One of my good friends from Israel has perfect English. And I was like, Alon, how do you speak English like this? He, like, no accent. And he goes, Game of Thrones.
Yeah. So he speaks exactly. British English?
Wow.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's move forward here. I think we kind of... Oh, that's last week. Okay. All right.
Okay.
So I'm gonna hop to question 4 here. Yeah. I think we kind of covered 3 pretty well, but I want to get a little bit more nuanced, because it's still in the same trajectory. But America's becoming increasingly secular in its outlook. How are Jewish people, especially programmatically, how are Jewish people retaining modern believers in a culture that finds belief in spiritual beings as silly and antiquated? Now, you already said there's kind of room for people who don't necessarily believe in it, believe in spiritual beings at all, to be part of the Jewish faith. But for people who see no value in what you bring to culture because of the connection to religion, or, okay, fine, is it cool for me to be non-religious? Okay, but when am I going to get the talk? When am I going to get the talk that you actually do have to believe some things? How do you retain people who find no value in religion whatsoever? Or in a culture that doesn't value religion, sorry.
I was going to say, from a program perspective, mm-hmm. from a programmer, our job is to create numerous portals into Judaism. And when I worked at my previous shul congregation, we assumed that not everyone would enter the doors of the sanctuary, that religion was not going to necessarily be their first choice of entry. So my job at the time was to provide many different opportunities, whether it was social action, whether it was education, whether it was culture, whether it was activities, to bring people in and to connect them to each other, to create a form of community, and let it go wherever they wished, or let them go wherever they wished. So it, as a programmer, it was not my job to connect them religiously. If they found that was a portal for them to enter, whether from another door, fine. But Judaism, as we've talked about, is so many different things, and so if they connect through nationalism, then we're going to have classes about Israel. If they connect through history, then it's historical. That's from a programmer perspective. Mm-hmm. Obviously, from other perspectives, there's different ways of doing it.
Okay. Sharon, what about you?
So I may push back on the question. Okay. On the one hand, I see that, I actually think that people are quite into beliefs and faith, and they may not all – yeah, I don't know, even based on the way the politics are going and just random surveys that you see. I would push back that may not be true. I think that people are questioning a lot more, and I would say in all facets of the Jewish community, sticking with what's been done for forever, I guess, a little bit. But I don't know. I think as a modern Orthodox Jew, I think that you're allowed to question. you're encouraged to question. That's part of the game. That's part of what makes it fun, and that's part of the tradition. I would also say that it's difficult for me to relate to some of this because I have been in the bubble, as I sort of opened with. So when I hear even secular music, it's often like colored by Judaism. When I like history, everything, like, it's all Jewish, because in some ways, like with the fiddler sort of thing, that if you've grown up enveloped in it and fully immersed in it, it's just, it's part of everything that you do. There are more people than in the past who are leaving the Orthodox tradition, but I would say it's primarily because of a lack of belief in God. And there's actually a huge percentage of people who are leaving because of the role of women. And that's what I do for a living. Partly because I don't feel like anyone should be kicked out of their home, and partly because I personally want this for me and for my colleagues and for my friends and for the community and even for my sons. So I would say in some ways for me, what speaks more truthfully to this question is a secular value versus our religion. So a secular value of egalitarianism or feminism, and how do I fit that or contest that with tradition?
I do wonder, just to push back a little on that, and yeah, the question might be phrased all wrong, and I fairly admit it's coming from the mind of someone who's thoroughly modern and moving into postmodern thinking. But for me, when it comes to almost anything, I mean, we could talk about politics for a second. Right now, they're mitigating whether Donald Trump said that people were from a shithole nation or not. So, like, people that were in the room were like, well, I don't know if he really said that. Like, you know these people are lying. Like, we know you're lying. You are not telling the truth. Correct. We are trying to get to the truth. Stop lying. We all get mad at liars, especially when you know they're lying, right? And so when it comes to religion for me, I'm not so much concerned with how it makes me feel or whether there are different portals to allow me in. I want to know if it's true or not. Am I wasting my damn time with this faith? I mean, a camp might be cool, but, you know, is it true? Is what I'm being taught true here? Hmm. And I guess, I mean, for me, it's like I feel like almost atheist is probably the perfect example of the person who's like, hey, look, if it's not true, I'm not wasting my time believing in any of it. And so when I look at Christianity, I'm like, okay, is it true? When I look at Islam, I go, is it true? When I look at Judaism, I go, is it true? And I'm wondering if the question of is this true, is this faith we hold, or in the cultural practices that come out of that faith you hold, whether you're just secular or not, it comes from the faith originally. Is it true, or are you wasting your time?
It's an interesting way to phrase that question. I would just think about this very differently, mm-hmm. but perhaps just because of the nature of how differently you and I grew up.
Yeah.
To me, like, even the value that I seek within Judaism is not truth in the sense of, like, is this a literal truth? Like, does God exist or not? I think to a degree, for me, faith involves an aspect of belief that exists outside of whether something is factually true or false in my personal belief system. To me, there's a feeling and an interconnectedness. You know, I could get into my own mm-hmm. spirituality, yeah. but for me, my spiritual journey exists outside of my pursuit of truth, if that makes sense. There's like it's two like just very different types of truth that I don't necessarily equate.
Okay.
For me personally. And I think just one more aspect, unless you want to keep
– No, keep.
One more aspect, just going back to the question really quick that I think Sharon was alluding to here, but just approaching it from a different angle. We're seeing huge I would not hesitate to call it panic within the Jewish community right now with an increase of interfaith couples, with people with individual Jews – pushing,
people are pointing to themselves right now, like, that's me.
defecting, as Sharon was describing. So it's interesting. There's this Pew study that I imagine someone else in the room could explain better than me, but a Pew study that's often cited today in Jewish circles that's pointing to an increase of interfaith couples, I think was the – but at the same time, I think also indicating an increase of engagement amongst – I don't know. Long story short, I apologize that I can't speak more eloquently about it, but this is a major point of concern and talking point, depending on who you ask, a point of concern or a major opportunity to be welcoming new people into the faith, depending on who you ask. Okay. So from my perspective, I'm in an interfaith relationship and am more engaged with my Judaism than I've ever been, and view my partner's background, that's so different from mine. I view that as enriching to my Jewish faith, not the other way around. And I think that's really hard for a lot of people that grew up in a more traditional Jewish setting to wrap their heads around. Naturally, I mean, I think it's alternative and it's a different way of thinking about it. But that's my truth. So, and I don't even mean to play back to the word truth.
No, sorry, it's
about
fine. That. No, that's fine.
But I think it's really interesting when we get into this whole concept of an increasing number of Jews defecting from whether it's belief in God or just becoming more secular with each generation. What was considered conservative a generation ago has changed with this generation. And then with the increase of expanding outside of strict social pressure to be marrying within the faith, I think you're going to see a continued evolution of what it means to be Jewish. And in my humble personal opinion, I think it's imperative that Judaism figures out a way to – that the Jewish community figures out a way to effectively engage interfaith couples and doesn't push them away.
And I think we're getting there. I think more and more we're seeing organizations who embrace this sort of new world and this new way to look at Jewish community. We have to. We have to change. We have to adapt and evolve, and we have to innovate in order to keep our community together and to serve our community in the ways that they're asking for. We need to meet people where they are. And like Ren was saying, there are different portals of entry. We're seeing more and more organizations now who are offering different things. You're an interfaith couple, come to this. You engage in your Judaism by, working the land and being on a farm. Here's an opportunity for you. And it's really beautiful. It's changing, it's evolving, and I think those who are embracing that are seeing really positive returns.
So, if I may, but being an observer to a lot of this happening, and from the Pew study to some of the things that Sarah was talking about, and agreeing with where they're coming from and the need to address them and the innovative ways that are created to address them, I believe it's a double-edged sword. Why is that? Because in the case to attract, retract, keep individuals, interfaith couples in the community, you to some extent put aside tradition and try to reinvent yourself and reinvigorate and make something new, funky to meet people, exactly where they want to be. And the question that I constantly ask myself is, what is tradition? And I mean, I know 10% of what my father knows when it comes to tradition and culture. And I have no doubt that my father knows 10% than what my grandfather knew. So, and I've been kept in an environment that is...
You don't have to go back too many generations before God enters the picture.
Exactly.
I mean, okay.
Exactly. So the question that it begs is, to what degree do you lose a part of your tradition and your ability to assure continuity to your community, to your people, in order to satisfy me where I'm at right now? And this is speaking someone who has a girlfriend who, again, converted to Judaism and went through this entire process. So to what degree do we need to satisfy now in order to assure longevity as a community? And where is that point? Because a lot of these organizations do amazing work of engaging young adults, interfaith couples, but it's also to a degree that, meet them exactly where they're at and what they like, putting aside tradition, so at the expense to some degree of tradition. So yeah, that's a question I'm battling with.
Now that's an interesting question, because on one side we have someone who converted, and your girlfriend is converting, and your girlfriend is not, but so you're interfaith. And so I wonder, does that go both ways? Because your girlfriend is converting, and you converted.
And look at where I am now.
But they – you converted and lost some tradition, right? And in a way it is – if you convert, you are turning your back on something else in a way. That's literally – convert means to turn, right? And so – no, repent means to turn. Either way. Somebody's losing something. So are you worried about your girlfriend losing her tradition by accepting yours? Or are you only concerned about her converting to yours so that we maintain our tradition here?
So, side note, I am the most excited person in our house for Christmas.
Okay.
I'm like the first person who wakes up. And it took me 3 years, but I got my own stocking this year.
Okay, all right.
I've moved up in life. So I just want to put it out there. But I think it's also a question of respecting heritage, respecting tradition. Her parents are complete atheists.
Okay.
But they celebrate Christmas. They celebrate, you know, Easter and stuff like that. And we 100% respect that. But as a couple, we decided that we want to be able to build a Jewish home.
Okay.
And we want to raise our family Jewish, and we want to install Jewish traditions and values and surround ourselves with people with similar background and inclination. But that by no means implies that we do not embrace, we do not respect, we do not look forward to, you know, spending time with her family and her tradition and her upbringing.
Right.
I think we can say with some authority here in this room right now that in the war on Christmas, Christmas won. because atheists and the Israeli military are getting psyched to celebrate Christmas.
Well, I think that's a good place to take a break. We're going to take a 5-minute break, refuel, use the restroom, and we'll be back in 5. Well, hey, everybody. Thanks so much for waiting on the line. We're going to jump right back into questions here. So we talked a little bit about and we've asked the same question all three of these podcasts so far about women. So some claim that Judaism is liberating to women. Others claim that Judaism has been stifling and abusive to women, such as in Hasidism. I just saw a documentary on Netflix called One of Us. It's pretty much all about not just abuses against women in that community, but it was a heavy focus in there. How do you see the treatment of women in Judaism?
Okay.
And I know Sharon's going to want to have to say something about this.
Exactly.
But until we get her back on, let's kind of address this real quick.
Having been involved in both Reform and Conservative Judaism professionally, I would say that I have not encountered much disempowerment of women. We certainly have in both sects. We have women rabbis, of which have full rights on in leading services. Educationally wise, we both Conservative and Reform have worked hard to make it more egalitarian in their teachings, more so Reform than Conservative, but certainly Conservative has made great inroads on that. I think Sharon is best to speak to the Orthodox question.
Okay.
But I would say it's been empowering.
Okay. So Sharon, do we have you back?
Yeah, if you can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you. So we moved on to question 6. Some claim that Judaism is liberating for women. Others claim that Judaism has been stifling and abusive to women, such as in Hasidism. I mentioned the documentary that came out on Netflix, One of Us. How do you see the treatment of women in Judaism?
Okay. I think it's very – you need to be careful when you use the word abusive because it's not to be taken lightly. From where I sit, I wouldn't call it necessarily liberating. I think there are some gifts that are. It's hard for me to speak to this without feeling like I'm giving sort of apologetics for where we're at. A lot of the reasons in traditional Judaism for why women are not doing a lot of things that they're doing is because traditionally mothers were in the home, they were taking care of many children without any form of birth control, and it was not feasible, it would have become onerous for women to make it to synagogue. That being said, women did go to synagogue, women had strong roles, women had jobs, all those sorts of things. also, I mean, I spend every day sort of trying to expand, not sort of, very much so trying to expand the role of women in our community in terms of ritual, in terms of leadership, in terms of not being othered, in terms of having a seat and a voice at the table. When it comes to the modern Orthodox community, in many ways, I'd say things are less challenging in the ultra-Orthodox community. Nonetheless, there was recently a survey done by Nishma Research by Mark Trencher, in which he studied people who have left Orthodoxy. And 26% of women who leave Orthodoxy leave because of the role of women, and 20% of ultra-Orthodox. So in the ultra-Orthodox community, that may mean that they can't drive cars, which all modern Orthodox women are readily available and allowed to do. I think what the important thing about is what is empowerment, and the definition that I would describe to you is empowerment is having access to resources or tools or whatever to accomplish what you want to accomplish in life. And I think one of the most challenging jobs for me was at Harvard, when a lot of students would ask me, like, how can you be an Orthodox woman? Like, how could you live with yourself? How could you consider yourself to be intelligent? All those sorts of things. And which is, you know, difficult to respond to. And there was one point where I was speaking to a mentor of mine, and I asked her for her advice. I said, what do I say? I said, they're looking at me like I'm a woman in a burqa. And she said, how are you looking at a woman in a burqa? And it was really eye-opening to me. I can't determine whether or not someone else is disempowered or if they're happy or unhappy. All of us have to be in charge of the decisions that we're making and how we are moving forward. So are there elements of being an Orthodox woman that are extremely challenging for me? Yes. Like, I never, I never would take on the title of Mrs. Once I became married, that's just totally against my value system, and yet I'm wearing something on my head, which is a sign of marriage from where I sit. So I think some things can be very complicated, and they're challenging, but I think as long as I'm still being challenged by them and still questioning them and struggling with them and trying to think creatively about how to adjust, then we're moving forward and we're making progress. And when in the Orthodox community, you actually see great change and progress happening now. It's not just that you have one single yeshiva ordaining woman as rabbis, you have a number of them. It's not like what was sort of controversial 10, 20 years ago is normal now. It's not a question of will you have a bat mitzvah. It's not a question of will you have certain roles within a wedding for women to be participating in generally in ritual. It's like, what do you want those to be? What do you want those to look like? How do you make it meaningful? So the questions have changed, and I'm hopeful in that respect. So, yeah, I'll stop talking now.
Okay. Sarah, what about you?
I grew up in a very progressive congregation. We actually had my rabbi growing up was one of the first openly gay rabbis, potentially in the world. I'm not exactly sure. Certainly in the country. Our congregation was full of different types of Jews, Jews who did not look the same. We had Jews of color. We had Jews who identified with the LGBTQ community. And it was something that I grew up with. It was very normalized. So I didn't even grow up understanding that women were disenfranchised in Judaism in any way. It wasn't until I, you know, experienced other forms of Judaism or spoke to other Jewish women who said, oh, no, women are not allowed on the Bima, which is a part of the synagogue where you lead services. So I don't have experience with this. I always felt very, very liberated as a woman in Judaism.
Okay, awesome. And just as Kent takes a giant swig of something, I will ask the next question.
No, I'm done. I'm out. I thought there were more people to talk. Okay.
I wanted to throw that to the ladies.
All right, just the ladies. What are your thoughts on organizations such as Jews for Jesus and Messianic Judaism? Is there room within Judaism for these groups, or are they by definition not Jewish? If yes, why? Or if no, why not?
And the reason I'm asking that question is because on our first week about what is Christianity, we had a Messianic Jewish rabbi on, and he was raised Jewish and then converted, and it was very, 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 very hard for him. He didn't go into all of that. I know his personal story because we've been friends for years. But he has said, you know, I've been told I am not Jewish. And it's interesting, given everything that's been said tonight about all the things that you – this, I mean, even people who don't believe in God can be Jewish. And so here's a guy who comes along and he's like, I believe in Jesus. And he's like, nope, you're not a Jew. So is there room for all the inclusiveness we were just talking about, is there room for those kinds of people?
So – it's really interesting. Sharon, you want to go first?
I'll be so quick. Sorry. And I'll just wait. That's where I said.
Okay.
There you go.
Well, okay, so why no?
It's a different faith. It's just a totally different ballgame. It's so funny because as you were asking me a question, I was laughing as I was on mute, but it's just, on the one hand, while we don't talk about belief all the time, if you're explicitly choosing a different system of belief and a different religion, then it's a different religion. It's just, it's too far in a different league, in a different ballpark.
But wouldn't atheism be the same thing? Like, if you don't believe in God and you guys believe in one God, that seems to also put you out. To be consistent, that would put you out of the Jewish faith to not believe in God, right?
So yep. I think when it comes to being who's Jewish and who not, and who is not Jewish, it was one question maybe like, can they have certain honors in synagogue? Can they have a seat at your table? Things like that. So I always think anyone can sit at my table, mm-hmm. but when it comes to certain things that require being Jewish, if you've actively chosen another religion, it's a different category, okay. Even though that may sound crazy.
No, that it does not sound crazy. It's fair, maybe because I look at atheism differently than Judaism does. I see somewhat of an inconsistency there, but Christianity looks at atheism differently than Judaism does. Right. So that might be the disconnect for me.
Sharon, would you say that is it true for broadly speaking within the Orthodox and ultra Orthodox community, would all people consider humanistic Jews to be Jewish, or converted Jews to be Jewish?
I think people in the Orthodox world see halachic Jews, so which meaning according to Jewish law, you're Jewish, and that in the Orthodox form of halacha, and that's how they would define who is and is not a Jew.
So
whether or not your mother was Jewish, and then I think that Hashem Limo descent is really within Reform movement to my knowledge. But the notion of like, well, I do everything Jewish. It doesn't matter how much you're practicing. If you're not a halachic Jew, if you're not either born Jewish or converted, then you're not Jewish.
Okay,
so just a widely different perspective on
absolutely.
On all that stuff.
Ren, I know you wanted to say something. So
I was going to talk about I run a Jewish film festival.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and therefore I have to screen a lot of different films. Too many. One of the
I love
films.
Movies. You can call me anytime.
Hey, come watch with me.
And it must be hard to find people in Hollywood of the Jewish faith. Okay.
Very difficult.
There are no Jews in Hollywood.
No Jews. One of the films that we screen and that we are showing is called A New Spirit, and it's about two brothers. It's a true story. Two brothers who grew up in Israel. And one brother, both obviously Jewish in this case, but one brother became a Messianic Jew and actually became a real leader of Messianic Judaism.
Okay. And is this a fictional film?
No, this is true.
This is a true story.
True
okay,
story.
Right.
Documentary. The interesting thing for me was to watch this film unfold and the story of these two brothers and the conflict, obviously, that was there. Messianic Judaism is a sticking point for Jews in general.
Mm-hmm.
I think you'll find 99.9% saying not
yeah, no.
part of Judaism.
Yeah.
Not it. But when you have a story like this laid out in front of you, it really makes you question, all right, he was born a Jew, his mother was Jewish, he converted to Messianic Judaism. What does that mean? And I was able to watch why he converted to Messianic Judaism or why he became a leader of Messianic Judaism. For me, I'm still uncomfortable with it. I can't wrestle it for me. And it's surprising because here I grew up with Jesus Christ as Savior. But it never resonated with me.
Right.
So therefore, it still doesn't resonate for me. I don't – when we show this film, because it's part of the Jewish Film Festival, we have to bring in a so-called expert on Messianic Judaism to do a talk back because we will get hit with a lot of negativity because we're showing this film. So it's within the Jewish community, this is not an easy put out.
All right. I guess it's fascinating to me, again, growing up Christian, going to school for – I have three religious degrees, all in Christianity, and so – and also thoroughly modern mindset. So for me, it's kind of interesting that I will look at, you know, Orthodox Judaism – or there are certain forms of Judaism that believe in a literal Messiah coming at some point. He just hasn't shown up, right? And then within Reform Judaism, it's like, eh, yeah, nobody's showing up. It's on us. That's who we are. And so there's a difference in who Messiah is for these two groups. And then Messianic Jews come along and say, yeah, the Messiah already came. So it's a difference in terms of, yes, it's choosing another religion, but within that religion, they're like, hey, we believe that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, but they're firmly out because Jesus is the head of the Christian faith and not believed to be a Messiah in the Jewish faith. So it's interesting, that disconnect, because Orthodox and Reform disagree on the nature and personhood of who Messiah is.
Do you think
and
that
Messianic Jews do as well, but they're not Jewish?
Do you think that Jewish? It is that it's more of a sore spot with that do you think that Jesus is more of a sore spot with Jews than atheism? Because in humanism, there's room to bring you into the Jewish faith, and with Jesus, it's more the Messiah was here, and you missed him. So it's an active mistake.
And how that's been used against Jewish people for a long time, right?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't even want to gloss over the fact that's been used to kill Jewish people for years.
I think it's a lot about this idea of a Messiah, or I personally don't believe in a Messiah. I believe I like to hope that there would maybe someday be a Messianic age, an age where the world is more perfect. And for me, in my Judaism, it's something that I strive towards. And as a community, we hope to become better. And we hope to make the world a more perfect place. We work towards tikkun olam, repairing the world, in the hopes that one day, if you believe in a Messiah, the Messiah will come. Or if you believe we are the Messiah, we continue to make the world a more perfect place. Or if you believe in this Messianic age, where maybe one day the world will be more whole, more perfect. And I think that if you believe that Jesus was the Messiah, you have to – there's almost this contention with working towards making the world a more perfect place or making the world more whole. Because if Jesus was it, where are we now? So for me personally, in my belief, that's where I struggle with Messianic Judaism, Jews for Jesus. It's tough. I'd still give them – I'd welcome them at my table. So I'd welcome anyone.
To your point, Ken, I think to talk about Jesus – and the fact that we might have missed, you know, we took a left and they took a right.
There was the fork in the road. And
exactly. At that point is you're talking about the foundation of Judaism. And to insert Jesus is to shift the story. And you have to understand that Judaism is based on oral tradition, then written tradition, and it is the epitome of tradition, believing in the whether it's the Messiah to come or the Messianic.
Like I said in the wrap up, I was in Fiddler on the Roof, so tradition.
Tradition.
I'm very very down with that. Yes,
but to alter that is to literally shake it at its base, and
how
many aren't willing to do that?
How is that shaking it at its base, but not believe? I mean, the very first words of everything you believe is in the beginning God, right? I mean, that's the beginning of Torah, right? So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. boom, 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 everything happens. He creates a people group. He impresses a story into them. They rebel. He loves them. They rebel again. He loves them again. Judges, kings, all these things go on, right? So at the core of your belief is God. And I've heard you say that that belief doesn't truly matter, but this question of is Jesus God is a point of contention for you. So it seems to me if you're going to push back on that, then the God question is more important to Judaism than I think you're letting on. At least that's how it comes across to me. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Sharon, you're trying to say something. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No. So I totally get where you're coming from. It makes a lot of sense. At the same time, I'm trying to think of... So on the one hand, I think it's really sociological what I was trying to say before in terms of belief, and that we don't talk about it, and it's just not a thing. And it's not like people go around the table, and there's not like when people have questions but ask the rabbi, they're often not asking that question, certainly in my circles. Mm-hmm. But when you take on a new belief that affects your practice and the core of the foundation of a religion, then it's a schism, and things are just so different. So, okay. Like, throughout Jewish history, you've had different schisms of Judaism and sects that pop up, and they tend to phase out because they're so radically different. And believing in a Messiah that has come, and then a very different way of practicing Judaism, early on, when you had Judeo-Christians, we were mighty similar, and the full difference was Jesus.
Right.
But now it's quite obvious that that's not recognizable at all, minus that there's some study of the Old Testament.
Absolutely correct.
I think that may help.
Okay, yeah.
I think just to add one more thing in here, I love what everyone's already explained, so I want to just take this another direction. Another piece to the puzzle is what Sharon was describing before about this notion of the mother being Jewish defining the child's
right.
Judaism.
Yes.
So. As a Jew, as a proud Jew in an interfaith relationship, where I grew up, I'd never thought about that. I didn't grow up in a community that thought about whether the mother of the child was Jewish or not. But now I find myself where, hypothetically, if me and my girlfriend do in fact stay together and have kids, holy shit, my kid doesn't have a Jewish mother.
Mm.
Does that mean my kid's not Jewish? What is that? You know, so I'm grappling with this very actively in my personal life now, what it means to be Jewish. Is my Judaism defined by the fact that my mom was Jewish, or is my Judaism defined by something else?
Genetics. Genetics
whatever.
Help.
I mean, right. Whatever it is. And I think you go back to – I think there's all sorts of things that I think it's a really interesting conversation. There's a piece of me that wants to say – you know, my Judaism is, you know, there's all types of ways that I feel connected to my Judaism that are completely independent of that. I didn't think about that growing up. It's not how, you know, I know. So anyhow, I think that that's a really interesting aspect. That's not considering whether or not the child was raised with the faith. That's whether or not the child had a Jewish mother.
Okay.
Shalom. Which impacts policy in Israel. I mean, it's like that's a real thing.
So let's talk about that policy. And Shimon, I'm sure you have thoughts on this, but we need to move forward, unfortunately. But I do want to start this next question with you, given that you're from the region. Let's talk about the Arab-Israeli conflict. We talked about this last week with our Muslim panel. So that was interesting. So
I don't imagine we'll be probably spending too much time on it with the atheists next week, because I don't know that they care.
Probably not, but you go ahead and ask the next question.
Okay. Yeah. About the Arab-Israeli conflict, many evangelical Christians seem to be reflexively pro-Israel. They couldn't care less about politics. It's for prophetic reasons. And both Jews and Muslims make prophetic and political claims to the region. What are the contours of the conflict as you understand it, and how can the conflict be solved?
And we have 10 minutes to solve the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Let's do it. We can do it.
Right.
We always do this
we'll
at
do
the end so we can attempt to solve this conflict in 10 minutes.
Shimon.
So, I mean, first and foremost, I think that it's important to understand that in order to understand the conflict, it's so important to understand religion, to understand history, to understand context, and to understand the fact that history is viewed by different people in different lenses. I think that, you know, just, again, giving a very, very, very abstract overview, the conflict revolves around four major issues: Jerusalem, land, security, and refugees, the right of return. That being said, and I'm putting the evangelical Christians aside, the prophetic Islam or Judaism, I'm putting all of that aside. It's important to understand that the conflict itself is an intractable conflict. Now, what defines an intractable conflict? An intractable conflict, and Northern Ireland is a perfect example of it, is where you have a mutual hurting stalemate, so both sides are hurting together. And the second part of it is where you understand that there is no future for your children, where the losses outweigh the gains mm-hmm. of perpetuating the conflict. And I think that's the major issue in Israel and Palestine, the fact that people do not understand that this conflict is intractable. It is not going anywhere, and any need to put a Band-Aid over an open wound rather than stitches, generationally surgically inserted stitches, is not going to resolve it. Because the perfect example is also geographically Israel. You know, you're 15 minutes away from Palestine. I grew up 20 minutes away from the West Bank, but a lifetime apart. Mm-hmm. You know, I never had any Palestinian Arab friends or Arab Israeli friends until I actively went seeking them after 8.5 years in the military, where, you know, I had one job in the military, and that was to maintain a certain security apparatus, which is second to none. So, you know, I have a very strong security kind of like apparatus and mindset, and that's first and foremost. But unless you can humanize the conflict, unless you can humanize the other side and talk to Arab Israelis, to Palestinians, like, you can never get anywhere. So that's as it regards to the conflict. As far as support, as an Israeli in a conflict, I will accept support from whomever is willing to give it. It's very, very straight. I don't care if they're black, brown, purple, yellow, anybody. It doesn't matter what their religion is, and it doesn't matter what their incentive is. You know, you're essentially in an ongoing conflict, and an ongoing conflict requires funds, requires personnel, requires support in the local arena, in the international arena. You know, I will accept it. Be whatever their reasons may be.
I feel like any Christian who's listening to this that we know checked out. They're like, nope, that's where Jesus is coming back. That's the only thing they're thinking, right? That's where Jesus is coming. And so, I mean, that I took a class on this in college, and I still felt like my brain was reeling in the end. So let me ask a direct question. I mean, I know the history. I majored in history on this, not on this particular topic, but I know the history of pretty much everything that happened after when Israel became a nation. Does Palestine have a right to exist?
I'm a firm believer of the two-state solution. I think that the only way in order to secure a reality in the Middle East for the Israeli public, demographically speaking, two generations down the line, the only way to do that is through having a demilitarized state, Palestine, and having the state of Israel. Because at the end of the day, only understand...
But not a demilitarized Israel.
Not a demilitarized Israel, no.
But a demilitarized Palestine.
150%.
Why?
Well, I mean...
I don't know why, so I'm actually asking why not as a leading question. But.
You know, they call it, you know, in the military and in Israel, they call it the Middle Eastern Bazaar. And this is something that, if I'm not mistaken, Begin or Golda Meir said this back in the 80s. If Israel tomorrow were to put up its arms and say, that's it, no more fighting, there will be no Israel. But if anybody of our Arab neighbors, by the way, we're surrounded by... Enemy countries per se, 19 countries around the world do not recognize an Israeli passport that as valid, as a passport, as a nation state, as a state with a right to exist.
Right. That's why I asked that question.
Countries that we've been in more than 7 wars and 15 kind of like major operations escalations over the past 70 years, right to exist. I believe I speak on behalf of my acquaintances, and I can tell you that if tomorrow all the Arab nations were to put, you know, completely hypothetically out of the blue, but to put their arms down and say, that's it, we want to leave in peace, Israel would be like the first country to say, let's put this away. There's a certain part of you growing up listening to the news every 30 minutes about either somebody wanting to kill you or either somebody killing themselves or blowing up or terrorist acts and how you need to get ready for war. Every 30 minutes, 24/7 on the radio, on the news, in the stoplights, that makes you as a society anxious. You know, you don't stand in line.
So I own a tour company. Just to that story, I own a tour company in Detroit, and I did a tour for the Jewish Federation. And it was a group of people coming from Israel. And, you know, I get used to just saying things over and over again because I'm a tour guide, and I'll be saying some specific point about history, but I'll be thinking, did I leave the iron on? You know, like I'm just like going through through rote things. And I remember taking them down to the Detroit River, and directly across the Detroit River is Canada. And they just started freaking out because they had no concept of a nation being that close and that nation not wanting to destroy you. So, I mean, to your point, I thought that was fascinating because I'm just like, yeah, it's just Canada. I can go over the bridge, no problem. I can go in the tunnel. We got two different border crossings within 3 miles of each other. And they're like, they don't want to kill you? They don't want to kill you. No, I mean, they got a casino, really, but they don't want to kill you.
They're really quite friendly.
Yeah, they're maybe a little too friendly.
Do you think, and this comes from not a place of scholarship, it's just something that has occurred to me. Do you think that when I was a child, 30 years ago, it seemed like the claim of Israel on that entire territory was taken for granted by pretty much everyone I knew. Do you think that in some communities with some people gets weaker as World War II disappears further back into history and fewer people remember it?
So I think probably Sarah and Jacob could also speak better to this than I could, but definitely. I think Israel went from being an underdog to being a force to reckon with in the Middle East. I think that as time progresses, and this is kind of like just the natural trajectory of intractable conflicts, you become more nationalistic, mm-hmm, on both sides, on the Israeli side, on the Palestinian side. And the question is, what does that result in? Are you a hegemon? Are you starting fights? Are you picking fights? Are you trying to dare other people to get into this? So these are all questions that I think a lot of, you know, what we call millennials in the state, especially Jewish millennials, are grappling with. And I'm sure Sarah Jacob could expand on that problem.
Just one thing I want to add, and being just extremely frank about my significantly diminished knowledge of the conflict, especially compared to Shimon and probably others in the room.
But with
my own experience, I've visited Israel twice. I have lots of Israeli friends. I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. The one thing I want to add to that is just that I think American Jews, there's this tendency, especially I can speak to the community that I'm from, communities that I've met elsewhere. There's a tendency to provide blanket support for the government of Israel, regardless of policy, specific policy, in a way that Americans don't even provide to our own government.
No.
So whereas, you know, Americans completely recognize the fact that half the country supports one candidate, half the, you know, that there's widely differing political views that shape our political landscape, but they don't afford that same thoughtfulness and like understanding of nuance to the conflict in Israel. So without getting into any of my own beliefs on the actual conflict, what I've experienced in visiting Israel is so many opinions like Shimon's, where it's a lo and behold, and I'm saying this blatantly sarcastically, there are so many different viewpoints within Israel of ways to, you know, progressive solutions, conservative solutions, whatever the case may be, but not all Israelis agree with the current position of the government, just like not all Americans agree with the current position of Donald Trump.
I completely agree with you.
So I think that's so important to remember, and something that so often gets lost is this concept that like all Jews blanket support the Israeli government, which is so far from the truth.
Completely agree.
Even though whether or not they support the ideals of Israel the same way that we believe in American ideals, many Jews believe in the ideals of Israel without necessarily agreeing specifically with the policies of the current Israeli government.
And I think that we have to, speaking as a former Jewish educator for a Reform congregation, and seeing how we teach our children about Israel, and being a child who was taught to love Israel no matter what, it's your homeland, don't ask questions, go to Israel, you know, be there, love your land. We don't, in my experience, in my community, we don't teach our children a whole lot about Israel other than the geography, and we teach them about falafel and hummus, and we don't give our kids a very good education, a very good understanding. And this may not be true of all Jewish communities. I'm speaking specifically where I grew up and the community that I worked with when I was in education. And to me, that is so sad. My hope for our Jewish community is that we can teach our children that you fight for something you love and you want to make it better. And in order to make something better, you recognize that it's not perfect. And that together we grow, we learn, and we move forward.
Well, Sharon, did you have anything to add?
I mean, there's a million things to add, but, it's the whole Israeli, So I think one thing to mention is that I find it challenging to weigh in when it comes to security measures as an American Jew. Until I make Aliyah, until I move to Israel, it's not my children's lives that are on the line, and so I find that to be challenging. And a major challenge between American Jewry and Israeli Jewry, in that how can you say how we could and should function if you're not there? And I wanted to share, I think the quote that you were alluding to was, from Golda Meir, peace will come when Arabs will love their children more than they hate us. Now, we read that in today's world, and we have Jewish Arabs, you know, so that's a difficult sort of sentence to take in. But I think there are two major things that keep me up at night when it comes to this. One is that in terms of Judaism, a Jewish value that overrides everything is pikuach nefesh, is saving life. So the sanctity of life is core to Jewish values, and the same is not necessarily true. There's a true value of martyrdom, which is just so different from what we're used to, and that's I think a part of this in terms of the religion end, but the other end is just the basic human values of giving people a reason to live, making sure that all people have access to water, education, hope, real life. And until Palestinians have a life that doesn't make them consider wanting to become a suicide bomber, we're not going to get all that forward. I would say that one last thing is that I certainly identify as a religious Zionist, and I think that as a former Jewish history teacher, I think it's important not to teach a false history or a false notion like this rosy picture. I think that pain and sacrifice is a huge part of Israeli history, and if you don't teach that, and if you don't teach the challenges in terms of a lot of things that have already been spoken to today, in terms of church and state, all those different sorts of things, then you're not being a true lover of your country, because the same way I can disagree with American politics, I can disagree and have strong opinions about the way that Israel is functioning as a state and country.
Awesome. Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank all of our guests for being here tonight. Fantastic conversation. Again, Jacob, thank you so much for spearheading this particular episode. All of you are absolutely welcome back on this show anytime. For our listeners, thanks so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. Make sure you check out our website, leadingquestionsnow.com, where you can find all of our episodes from this season, the last two seasons, bios, a calendar of upcoming topics, and even suggest topics for us to talk about. If you're interested in bringing our program out to your college, university, or organization, email us at hello@leadingquestionsnow.com and we'll get back to you. Don't forget you can find us on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and the Podcast Detroit app. Please leave us a review. That's very, very important. And tune in next week where Kent and I will conclude our series titled Sacred Space. We've invited on several atheists and skeptics.